Marcus were raped and murdered. Would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?
No, I don't, Bernard, and I think you know that I've opposed the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime.
Dukakis's measured and rational response to his wife's hypothetical rape and murder only reinforced the perception of him as an inadequate protector and not tough enough for the job. Bush ended up with 63% of the white male vote and trounced Dukakis in a 40-state landslide. A message was being sent loud and clear to white men that a real man wouldn't even consider voting for a Democrat.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m. Next up is The Bike Show. Good day and welcome to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, on 90.7 FM and streaming at kbo.fm. All shows are also archived at www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. Our engineer today is Ty Walker. I hope the fall season started well for all of you and that it will be a time of renewal, health, joy, a season of peace and justice too. And for those noting the Jewish calendar, Shana Tova, Gmar Chatima Tova, a good new year, and may you be inscribed in the Book of Life. My name is Alon Rab, and I'm joined today by co-host Nedra Deadweiler, who is in Atlanta. Good day, Nedra. How are you today?
Hey there, Alon.
How are things great in Atlanta?
It is sunny, it's warm, and yeah, things are pretty good.
And hopefully that also extends to the political season and the election results coming upon us. Amen. In today's show, two worker-owned bicycle businesses and projects will be featured. In the first half of the show, Nedra will speak with Ruthie Woodring of Northampton's Pedal People. The worker-owned business has just celebrated 20 years of operation, hauling garbage and compost by bicycle, and in the process, building and fostering community. Happy birthday to you, Pedal People, and many more years. In the second half of the show, our guests will be longtime Portland cyclists and activists, Roger Noren and Sora Stout, who will talk about some of their projects over the years, and also talk about City Bikes, a worker-owned store in Southeast Portland that Roger founded in 1986 and that Sora was a member of for 15 years. City Bikes is going through a rough and contentious period, one we hope will give way to renewed cooperation and camaraderie. Our first guest today is Ruthie Woodring of Pedal People, a worker-owned business that holds garbage and compost by bicycle, and in the process, builds and fosters community. Ruthie will be interviewed by co-host Nedra Deadweiler. Nedra, take it away.
Thanks, Alon. Sorry for the echo. Hi there, Ruthie.
Nice to talk with you again.
Yeah, it is great. It's great to have you here on KBOO Radio Bike Show. I think that your work with Pedal People is amazing. In addition to offering recycling and trash pickup, compost service, you also offer a free bike lab, which is amazing. If we want to grow cycling across, you know, wherever we are, we have to offer some sort of education around repair and maintenance and being smart on the street, because they can be mean streets too. Once again, my name is Nedra Deadweiler. I'm here on KBOO Bike Radio Bike Show with Ruthie Woodring of Pedal People. Hey, Ruthie.
Hey,
you ready to talk?
Yeah, I'm ready to talk. so Pedal People, right, we've been around for about 20 years. My friend Alex Sterrett and I co-founded it in 2002. So we haul trash, recycling, compost, yard care, we haul furniture, we do the bike lab, we have a contract with the city to empty all the public garbage cans downtown. But the reason that the trash hauling works, the reason people hire us to haul their trash is because there's no municipal trash service in Northampton, Massachusetts. It's all privatized. It's always been that way. And so when I moved to Northampton from Chicago in 2002, I'd been living at a Catholic worker house there in Chicago for about 9 years off and on. And then I moved to Northampton, and Alex, who lived there, he and I were both car-free. He had a bike trailer to haul his own trash and recycling and to the transfer center. And we're like, well, you know, people are paying out of pocket to hire trucking companies, to contract with trucking companies to haul their trash and recycling. Like, we know we can haul our own. We know people have the money to pay someone to do it, and there's a transfer center that's, like, within, like, 3 miles of most of the majority of the population. It's like, well, maybe people will pay us instead of the trucking company. And this was, like, October, November. We were heading into winter, and we're like, oh, we don't know about Massachusetts winters. Like, I'd been a bike messenger through a few Chicago winters, so I knew I could bike through winter, but could I haul 300 pounds of trash on the back of a trailer on a wintry road? Well, we started in December with just, like, one customer. Actually, before we started, I should say that the transfer center, the city-run transfer center, where Alex was taking his stuff at that time, it was just a residential drop-off site. And we were trying to become commercial haulers. And so I called the city and was like, hey, my friend Alex and I, we want to start this trash hauling business by bike. And we were wondering if we could come to the transfer center with it. And the person on the other end of the line said, wait, you want a what? I said, oh, we want to start this trash hauling business by bicycle, and you know, we were wondering if we could come to the transfer center. And she said, well, I know as a commercial hauler, we, you know, that's not allowed. You'll have to go out to the landfill. And I was like, ooh, that's like a hilly 6 miles away. I don't think that's really feasible for us. Is there anybody else I could talk to? And the woman was like, well, why don't you call back tomorrow and you can talk to my boss? And so I called back the next day, and it's like, hey, we want to start this trash hauling business by bike, and we're wondering if we can come to the transfer center. And the woman, Karen Broquillan was her name, she said, oh, I think that's great. I'll send you a permit sticker for your bike in the mail. And I was like, wait,
wow.
You understood? You understood what I meant? We want to come with, like, as a commercial hauler? And she said, I think that's great, and I think the city should support businesses like that. Yeah, so if it wasn't for her, for Karen being in that place at that time, I don't think Pedal People would have ever got off the ground. So we started, when we started in 2002, Alex and I, like, we had both come from cooperative kind of backgrounds, in a sense. Like, he had done a lot of cooperative stuff at a Quaker high school that he had gone to, and I had lived at the Catholic Worker. I had grown up as, like, the youngest of 8 kids and a 10-person family, and had done cooperative stuff. So we knew when we started the business that we didn't want to be anybody's boss. That's not my idea of a good time, telling people what to do. So we started just the two of us for those first couple years, and then some friends. We started really small, just like one customer the first day, the first route, the first pickup. Maybe by the summer of
that.
Uh-huh. Year, we had maybe 7. Is it okay? Should I keep going, or do you want to go in any other direction yet?
Yeah. I would love to jump in there with a question or two.
Okay.
It didn't require a lot of political maneuvering for you to get that pass to start doing the commercial. Are you hearing my echo?
I do hear the echo.
Okay.
I don't know what.
It didn't require a lot of political maneuvering But I am wondering, when it came to making a decision to do this work, what other decisions, what other opportunities came in front of you to go into a cooperative? Do you have other choices? Did you, in terms of structure of your organization?
So when we first started, we had no idea if it was going to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know, you know, am I going to be here every Wednesday for the rest of my life hauling 10 customers worth of trash because that's all we can get? So we didn't know if it would grow or not or be economically feasible. We didn't know if we'd be able to make a living doing it. So Alex and I both had other part-time jobs that we gradually cut back on as we did more pedal people work.
Mm-hmm.
So we operated really informally the first maybe 3 years from 2002 till around 2005, I want to say, and grew really slowly in terms of customers and bringing in new pedal people. And at that point, we were just a DBA under Alex's name. And customers would pay us with checks, and we would cash them and just do everything kind of by cash. And then after about 3 years, we were maybe up to 5 pedal people by then, and the city said, hey, what about you put in a bid for a contract emptying the downtown trash barrels? And we were like, whoa, we better get organized if we're going to do that. And they said, yeah, you'll need liability insurance too. So it was at that point that we decided to incorporate with the state of Massachusetts and do everything. Like, we hired a lawyer, and we did everything, like, well, I don't know, like, the paperwork legit above board from that point on. Yeah, like for worker cooperatives in the area in Western Mass, now there's an organization called the Valley Alliance of Worker Cooperatives that's super supportive of trying to get cooperatives supported or started, converted, and supported. There's also the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. When we first started, we copied our bylaws off of Collective Copies, which is a copy collectively run copy business in Florence, Massachusetts, where we live. So did that answer the question somewhat?
Yeah, I think it answers the questions pretty well. Over the years, since it's now been 20 years, and you've worked through a lot of those nitty-gritty details of setting up your cooperative, what have been some changes over the past 20 years in terms of growth, in terms of how you've been able to resolve challenges? What are some pieces, some nuggets that you've learned over this 20-year period?
Well, we changed our bylaws maybe 6 or 7 years ago. The initial bylaws were pretty quirky and said things like, we believe in the idea of low-income living as a counter to the work, consume, spend lifestyle common in America today. And as we grew, I think it became the is that crow annoying? Can you hear that crow? Sorry.
Yeah, we can hear it. It's okay.
I feel like we've become less of a kind of a mission-oriented group that makes money to a job almost. The new mission statement, it took out that line that I read previously, and I forget what it said. Something about understanding that social justice isn't possible, or environmental justice is not possible without social justice. Still a nice mission statement, but... So things that have been challenges. As we've grown, we've made subcommittees for this, that, and the other. Every idea, there's a proposal made to make it into a policy. Basically, we have a lot of like policies, you know, experiences that then result in policies being made, and then something else happens, and we're like, oh, maybe we need to review this policy and change it. Also, over the years, like the first few years since Alex and I started the organization and basically committed multiple years of our life to getting it going and sustaining it, early on, I feel like there was more of that founder syndrome power inequality thing where we had so much of the background knowledge and experience and connections about who to talk to and how things worked. That there was that power imbalance, but I feel like over the years, as more people have come in and Alex and I have stepped back from lots of things, to me, like, people, like, I've been around the longest, well, Alex and I have, and, like, I'm outside doing routes a lot, so I'm very public, but I actually don't know nearly as much as most of my coworkers about how the business actually runs.
Mm-hmm.
and that's just
Was that by choice? Was that by choice, being more on the bike and public facing versus behind the scenes, or...?
That's just kind of more my skill set.
Mm-hmm.
My skill set is more like being a friendly athlete. And you know, we try and, you know, the business is the hiring committee, which I'm not on. The hiring committee has hired people that bring in other skill sets, like secretary type skills, consensus building skills, facilitation skills, programming skills, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let me do a station announcement real quick. This is KBOO, Radio Bike Show. We're listening with Ruthie Woodridge of Pedal People, and I'm your host, Nedra Deadweiler. So in the tradition of cooperative, I mean, there are some big ones like Mondragon in the Basque region of Spain, which employs thousands of people and has businesses, you know, a number of businesses underneath its umbrella. How do you think we can spread that type of business development or cooperative development here to bring about a more egalitarian way of doing business and working like as you do with your skills that that we're good at and not trying to fit into a mold?
Yeah, well, the way I use my skill set to try and further cooperatives is when I talk about Pedal People or that worker cooperative stuff, I'm always telling people, and you know, there's the Valley Alliance of Worker Cooperatives, there's the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, there's these other organizations that can support people who want to do that kind of thing. Yeah, we've seen a bunch of businesses convert to co-ops in Western Mass. And just trying to normalize the idea of there not being a boss in your workplace. Yeah, and I just sort of take it for granted myself because I've never really, I haven't really existed in those social or work situations too much.
Yeah.
So just like whatever situation we're in, just trying to, I don't know, encourage people to think egalitarian and to take initiative where they're able and to recognize that we know there doesn't, like, hierarchical structure isn't like human nature. Not necessarily. I mean, there's all different kinds of human nature, so, but it's not like that shouldn't be like the norm or the assumed norm.
Yeah. Well, it seems like your answer was just what we're normalizing and to normalize something different, being able to see that model successful. And I think that is very helpful. So I appreciate you sharing your story, Ruthie, and just how you came about. And even though part of the question was looking at what sort of values you operationalize within Pedal People, I think that the one thing that I am fixated on human first. And it's even in your name. So congratulations.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks.
What is next for Pedal People, and what is next for Ruthie? Because you're always on an adventure.
Yeah. For Pedal People, well, one of the things that we're wrestling with right now is this whole idea of should we use e-bikes or not, or to what degree, some degree or not. Like, I feel like e-bikes are about doing more faster, and we don't want that to be the new normal. Well, that's always a new normal, but we want to reject that as much as we can, yet still make a living and not injure ourselves. So that's one thing that Pedal People's dealing with. Me, personally, I'm fixing bikes, collecting bikes. I was trying to ship some to Haiti now. I did a shipment to Trinidad a couple of years ago, Bikes Not Bombs style. And I work with like domestic bike redistribution efforts too. So all kinds of things related to bikes, I guess, are next for me. Yeah, maybe writing more parodies. I told you I'd written this. Pedal People likes to write parody songs.
Well, yeah, so we have a treat, radio audience. Ruthie, will you roll into it?
Yeah, can I sing?
Please.
All right. I saw it sitting there on the side of the street. I could tell it must have been there about 2 weeks. The wind was smelling strong, like something dead and gone. And I knew it wouldn't be long till it was with me. Yeah, me. Singing, I love hauling trash. Put another bag on my trailer, baby. I love hauling trash. I'm never gonna stop because it never ends. There's compost in the trash and bottles too. Diapers, kitty litter, doggy doo. I know you think they're cute, and that I can't dispute. But to me, they're just a source of landfill goo. Do I love hauling trash? Put another bag on my trailer, baby. I love hauling trash. Never gonna stop, cause it never ends. I got my load piled up and all strapped down. I'm headed for the depot across town. I'm just about to go, when out comes my friend Bo, saying, one more bag, can you take it? Please don't say no. And I say, I love hauling trash. Put another bag on my trailer, baby. I love hauling trash. I'm never gonna stop, cause it never ends. Now plastic is the worst of all my woes. From the earth it comes but never goes. The oil barons tell us that we need the things they sell us, while the waste around the world just grows and grows. So I'm still hauling trash. Put another bag on my trailer, baby. I'm still hauling trash. Never gonna stop cause it never ends. Yeah, I love hauling trash. Riding my bike is finding treasures. I love hauling trash. Rain or snow or windy weather, I love hauling trash. Bricks and sticks and leaves and leather, I love hauling trash. But all I really want to haul is feathers.
Woo! That was amazing.
Thanks.
Yeah. Whenever Pedal People open up to subsidiaries around the country, please let us know. I think you'd have people lined up to sing and pick up trash, haul trash with you.
we try to support anybody doing worker cooperative, like bike collection. Compost is a big, it's like that's where the biggest, easiest market is now, I think, because most cities have municipal trash service. But yeah, we love to support people trying to do compost collection by bike in a cooperative way.
Yeah. Very cool. Thank you, Ruthie. Yeah, this is great. Great to talk to you again in a more formal way. Thanks for being on KBOO, Radio Bike Show. Turning back over to you, Alon.
My bike. All right. Thank you, Nedra, and thank you, Ruthie Woodring of Northampton's Pedal People, a cooperatively owned bike-powered transportation company that provides garbage and recycling hauling services for the city's public trash cans and for individual households. Sorry for the echo, which plagued part of the conversation. And today, we're speaking about some bicycle worker-owned businesses. We just heard about Bicycle People in Northampton, Mass. And now we'll talk about another one here in Portland. A worker-owned bicycle business that is in the midst of crisis. Sadly, Portland City Bikes, a bike store that has been around since 1986, is in the midst of a less than harmonious situation. Several current members are trying to sell City Bikes buildings and close this 36-year business and community resource. In our show, we like to focus on the many sustainable and life-affirming things that cyclists and cycling organizations all over the world are doing, helping build a better world. In today's second half of the show, we will also address a less happy development. I invited all sides in the debate to be here today and share their perspective, but did not receive a reply from those seeking to close City Bikes. If individuals connected with City Bikes, not represented here today, would like to reply to what is said here, please contact me at alonekrob@gmail.com, and I would be happy to present your view in the next month's show. Sora Stout and Roger Norin have been at the forefront of many of Portland's innovative projects in Portland for many years. Roger founded City Bikes, a wonderful bike shop, in 1986. Sora co-founded Shift to Bikes, the World Car Free Network, the KBO Radio Bike Show, and much, much more, as well as being a fantastic artist. Both Roger and Sora are also fantastic bicycle mechanics, and I speak from personal experience. Good morning and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Alan and cable listeners. It's wonderful to be here.
And you are also one of the founders of the bike show, so thank you for that also. Before we get to the situation at City Bikes, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, maybe some of your early bicycle experiences?
Okay, well, I was born in Stockholm, Sweden, and lived in Berlin, Germany for much of my childhood. And my father was a very keen cyclist, at least for transportation, and took me around on his bike. And then I got my own bike, and I've been cycling ever since. So that's 65 plus years. I never learned to drive. I made that decision when I was 15 while bike touring in the Netherlands, which, of course, we all know is a paradise for cycles. And I moved to Portland in 1981, and I was very fortunate to be hired at the predecessor of City Bikes at the 1914 Ankeny location, the Bicycle Repair Collective, which, as the name would imply, was a collectively run nonprofit shop where we helped people fix their own bikes, and I learned a tremendous amount working there. And when they decided to move to a larger premises up on Belmont, I decided to stay because I thought it was important to keep a community bike shop at that location, since there'd been one there since 1976. And I also thought Portland should have a used bike shop. And I was inspired by a place I came across in New Zealand which only had used bike parts. And I thought, wow, what a great idea. So that's me in a nutshell. And then I guess after 4 years of total burnout, I saw the film about Mondragon, which was mentioned in the first half of this show. And I was inspired to hire Tim Calvert to turn City Bikes into a worker-owned co-op. And it has been one since 1990.
Okay, thank you, Roger. And what about you, sir? What are some of your early bicycle experiences?
Well, my life is rich with bicycle experiences, starting with my wonderful mom who carried my sister and I on her bikes. And that's pre-memory, so I just have a picture. But I think it's kind of part of, you get the experience of that. It just kind of gets in your blood or something. But I also rode my bike to school in middle school, and then became very enthusiastic once I moved to Oregon for college. Then I discovered I wanted to go explore on bicycle to see where I was, and I borrowed a bicycle from somebody in my dorm, and I just rode all over Portland and became just interested in going places. I remember just wanting to ride to the Mount Hood and just getting on my bike and trying to get to Mount Hood, just the kind of foolish, like, exploring things in my young days. And then I did an amazing bike trip with one of my friends from college, and we set out to head back to New York, which is where I'm from, on bike. And that was just amazing. We took the Transamerica bike route, and we ended up just in Missoula, Montana, and then to Yellowstone National Park, and then ended up crossing by a Volkswagen van that was being towed by a U-Haul truck. But then I was like, after having ridden 80 miles a day with all my stuff over mountains, and that I had learned how to fix my bike to a certain degree, and I was biking to work, I was biking here, I was biking there, and I came back to college, and the following summer, I remember coming into City Bikes to adjust my brake after having done something to my bike where my brake was messed up, and I came in and I asked if I could use a tool, which is an innocent thing. You don't always get to do that in a bike shop, mm-hmm. but it seemed like a friendly place, and I thought maybe they would loan me a tool. And I started chatting with somebody there, and he suggested I should ask Roger for a job. And I was like, wow, that could be like the funnest thing ever. Like, I didn't actually think that could be possible. And then I had a job. Roger said, sure, come in on Monday. And I remember coming in, and Roger had a bike that looked like it had been buried in a swamp for like maybe kind of some years. And he said, yeah, here's some books. Why don't you take it apart, put it back together? Here's some grease if you have any questions. And it actually was, for me, just the most freeing moment, because I had a lot of formal education. I learned a lot of math. I learned a lot of cultural history. I learned about all kinds of things. And then suddenly, and I studied sculpture, but none of it is especially practical. But suddenly, all of those things kind of converged, and I could do something that was very practical, very helpful to people, put me in touch with the community. And it was like, it's actually science and physics, and then your hands are on it. And it just kind of satisfied so many things for me. And I sort of found my little home there. And I worked there from that point for about 15 years, some breaks here and there. But that's the beginning of my story. And, you know, we could go on and on.
And the rest is her story. Before we get to City Bikes and what's going on there today and what kind of place it was, I want to second what you said. As a customer, as somebody who came into the shop, there was a different sense, there was a different kind of feeling for people who came with their bikes. I got a sense that the mechanics, the people at work, they really care about the customers, really want to make sure that we get the best bikes possible. There wasn't any attempt to sell the most expensive, shiny product from Italy or France or wherever they come from, China these days. As a customer, I always felt that I'm with caring people who are concerned about the environment, concerned about recycling, concerned about the world. And that was my sense always, as well as meeting some wonderful people that became friends. Before we get to City Bikes, I just want to ask you, Sora, again, a little bit about, for those of who are new to Portland, you know, you've been involved in so many wonderful projects. Could you maybe talk briefly about Shift to Bikes or any of the other projects that have been really important to you?
Well, I'll say that just my desire to explore on a bicycle and to use a bicycle as a utility vehicle, that I discovered pretty quickly that there was inhospitable conditions out there. I remember just innocently crossing the Ross Island Bridge thinking I was going downtown, and then I was stuck in a place where I couldn't go anywhere. You had to cross two lanes of very dangerous, obviously dangerous, automobile fast-moving traffic to get to the next place. And then I became very vocal. I just was like, who do we tell? What do we do? What do we do? And I started becoming that you know, little pesky citizen who was calling, this is unsafe, it's not marked, you could just go there and then you're gonna have a problem with traffic. And so I became kind of activated, as it were, and probably the first project that led to others was Critical Mass Bike Ride. And so just being a person who biked all the time, sort of obsessively everywhere and all the time, I encountered difficult situations all the time in traffic. The conditions weren't as good as they are now. And from encounters with cars, you would just feel threatened. And so Critical Mass became, I saw a flyer for Critical Mass. It just said, "Are you tired of being run off the road? Come ride with others." And I went and I rode with the first ride of Critical Mass, and it was hundreds of people. And so just a very different feeling than riding all by yourself. And also an immediate connection to other people who bike, because when you're a biker, sometimes you can feel kind of lonely. You're out there, everybody else seems to be in a car, and then suddenly we were all together. "Hey, I like your bike. Hey, that's a cool helmet." And everyone was chatting, and "Let's do this again." And we did that again, and that's like an interesting story. But I was enthusiastic about the potential of Critical Mass, and I was very determined to make it as positive as the first ride. And it was not always as positive as the first ride. There was a lot of difficulty with police and some with motorists. And so that project became a struggle. And after many years, then there was a bike summer came to Portland. And I'm going to not be able to cite the exact year, but early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And this was an idea that started in San Francisco, and it was kind of based to try to just diversify. Instead of having just one Critical Mass or one, you know, like a government-sponsored events and things, that it would be individuals having events every day. And so there was a calendar, and anyone could put an event on a calendar, and people would come. And maybe sometimes lots of people would come, and sometimes not lots of people would come. And there were very diverse events. There was one that was like a bicycle orchestra, and people played music on, you know, by tapping on the spokes of bicycles. And then there was like the Heritage Tree Ride, where you would go and visit all the trees. And this, again, just seemed like a fantastic project, and it worked for a month one summer. And a group of us decided we wanted to continue in that spirit and have a calendar where anybody could make an event and publicize it through the platform of Shift. And there we went, and it still exists. And Pedalpalooza happened this year. It's kind of concentrated in an event in the summer, but it goes year round, and it's just a place where there's a listserv and people could discuss issues, and there's just people, like-minded people can get together, and that's Shift.
And knowing you a little bit over the years, that is one of the many things I admire about you, is when you see a problem or situation that needs fixing, you don't wait for others, but you jump ahead and create something wonderful that then carries on. And Critical Mass has just celebrated 30 years. It started in San Francisco, and they just had a ride over there with thousands of people. And I'm proud to say that I participated in the second Critical Mass ride ever in San Francisco. I missed the first one, but I was there in the second one. We could talk more about these projects and others, and we might get to it at the end, but let's go back to you, Roger, and talk a little bit about City Bikes. So the first few years before you decided to change its structure, what was it like in City Bikes in the late 80s? What kind of store it was, and what distinguished it maybe from other bike stores at the time?
Well, before I did study education, and my specialty or my big interest was free schools like Summerhill and stuff. So City Bikes was kind of like a free school bike club. It wasn't really a viable business until it became a co-op. And I guess that's my fault, but you know, you walk in the door and there's like a comfy chair in a library, and half the books were bike books and the other half were political books, and there were posters on the walls, and there wasn't any merchandise visible. It was all hidden in the back like a European grocery store. And you know, when I hired Tim Calvert, he said, do you have anything for sale here? And I said, yeah, it's all back here. And he says, well, so the next day he came in and he put up a pegboard and he hung merchandise on the walls. And guess what? People started buying them. And we started making money and we could pay people and we could afford things. But anyway, it was rough for me because I would come in and work until, you know, from 11 in the morning until 2 in the morning and get some sleep and come back the next day, whereas everybody else just showed up when they felt like it because we didn't have a schedule. It was kind of lame, to be honest. And it's way better as a co-op. I mean, the structure of the co-op and having all this diversity of talents and ideas and people making suggestions. And it's like, hey, you know, propose it. And if everyone thinks it's a good idea, let's do it. And I loved working at City Bikes when it was a co-op. And I have to say, I loved working at the Bicycle Repair Collective, which was also collectively managed. I would like to say one thing, though, about the term worker-owned. You don't really own the co-op. You're stewards of the co-op. You come in, you put in a couple $1,000 as a kind of a fair share, which you get back when you leave, and you get profit sharing, or if there's losses, you share in the losses. But you don't really own the assets. You just don't have a boss. And that's a nice working environment.
And kind of unusual in this society, even though there have always been models like that going back hundreds of years. You are listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, on 90.7 FM and streaming at kbo.fm. Our guests are Roger Noren and Sora Stout, longtime bicycle activists in Portland and elsewhere. And we're talking also about the worker-owned business, City Bikes, that they've been involved in for many years, and some of the challenges and problems today. So, Roger, when you decided to change the structure and make it a worker-owned, how did you go about it? Did you have a good lawyer? Did you read the fine print? Or did you just operate on the basis, as in many marriages and relationships, hey, I love this person, we could trust them forever. I could trust him with my life.
Well, not exactly. I went to a screening at Laughing Horse Books, where you worked, and it was about the Mondragon experiment in Basque region of Spain, which was talked about in the first half of the show. And I was totally inspired by it, and I thought, this is wonderful. And of course, Burley Design Cooperative down in Eugene, where we got rain gear and trailers and stuff, was also an inspiration. And then one day, Tim Calvert, who was the founder of Laughing Horse, or one of the founders, along with Alone and his partner Jan, came into the store and he asked for a job. And I said, well, could you turn it into a co-op, a worker-owned co-op? And he said, yeah. I said, can you do it by the end of the year? This was like August. He said, sure. And so we bought this book at Laughing Horse called We Own It, which has a bunch of templates of bylaws and stuff and how to set up a co-op. And Tim got his typewriter out and started typing up bylaws for this new co-op. And then Mike Kennedy, who was one of the bright young people who worked at the City Bikes then, said, well, we ought to have some kind of clause for if the business dissolves in the future and we have to distribute the assets. And so they added a clause about that. But it was, and the law, they did hire a lawyer who reviewed it and said, yeah, this looks good. And they moved on. And I never actually read the bylaws or the articles of incorporation. I just, the policies that we developed over time, that was our boss. So I was very familiar with the policies and we all abided by the policies. And if we didn't, well, we get asked why not, and you know, we'd have a little conference and say, you know, you need to be more attentive to this little detail because it all works better when people abide by the policies. Mm. And I was fine with that.
And sir, you were involved with your member for 15 years. What was it like to work there? Was it different from other bike shops you were at? And also, how did you deal with conflict, disagreements? Was every decision made by consensus?
Well, I will say at first that I did work there when it was just owned by Roger, and where he describes it as lame because he was under stress. It was actually Roger's gift to the rest of us because it was a wonderful place. And if you imagine walking into a store and there's a place for you to sit and books for you to read and people for you to talk to, and they would actually loan you tools and they would teach you how and all that. It was just a giant gift. And I learned a lot there. It was really, that was where I first got my hands on the tools. And I don't think there's any other business that I've ever experienced that was anything like when Roger was the sole proprietor of the business. It certainly wasn't a capitalist model just because he owned it and he was, you know, the boss, but there was no bossing to be done. He didn't do it. But it was freeform, so it in some ways didn't work. You know, we would say like, I'll be back on Tuesday, and then he'd have to pick up any slack if Monday was something. So it was not right for Roger, unsustainable. And then working at the co-op, it became more, I learned to think of the business kind of as a family member. It was like, this is the person who cares for you. It's not exactly a person, but if you care for the business, it will give back to you. And so as part of the co-op, we all developed policies that would benefit us and would also benefit the business, because if you give to the business gives back to you. So it was an entity, and it was part of the relationships between the people, was that it wasn't just your coworkers, but it was your coworkers and the benevolent entity of the shop, which gave you your paycheck and also provided, you know, benefits that you developed that you wanted. We had a health stipend, so you could either buy insurance or you could use it to buy vitamins or you could get a massage. Things like that. Like, we wanted that, we developed that, we made funds for that, and then because the shop was giving to us, we wanted to give back to the shop. So it was very just awesome. And there was certainly conflicts and there was difficulties, and we had processes and procedures for dealing with them, but to have conflict out in the open is a healthy thing, and it makes it much less likely that you're going to have really unpleasant conflicts if you deal with minor conflicts all the time. And it's really is sort of expected. A conflict means that you've identified an issue that it's like, let's bring on the ideas, let's see how we can make it better. And that, I think, is the most special thing about the co-op model, is that it's assumed that each person has valuable perspective and they're going to bring valuable ideas to the table, and that everybody's idea should be heard and that they should synthesize into a process that works for everybody. And I have worked in other shops, and I have to say that I find that all bike shops are awesome, because the mission of bike shops is to be a place where people can get support in their biking habit. And I just think that biking is good, and people being able to bike is good. There's nothing wrong with it. And if you have a good system, whether it's from a boss or it's from a co-op, I just believe it's a good thing.
And our time is just flying by. We have about 10 minutes, so let's get now to what's going on today. Roger, can you explain what's happening at City Bikes and what are you doing or what can be done?
Well, I haven't personally worked at City Bikes since 2008, which at which time it was a very successful business. We had an apprentice program where we were able to hire people who didn't have bike mechanical experience, and a lot of women especially, and we wanted to have gender parity. And I left because, yeah, it was getting too big for me. You know, I think there was like 25 or 30 people there. There were 16 owners. And I thought it was time for the younger generation to kind of take over and not be one of the old geezers who thought we knew it all.
So now there are four members, and what are they trying to do?
Well, that's the problem. You see, it got smaller. Like, the financial crisis happened in 2008. They ultimately closed the annex, which is across the street from KBOO here, and they got down to a smaller size, and it got down to where there's only four owners. And so one of those, the current owners, read the bylaws and the articles of incorporation, and he realized that if he could persuade two other people to go along with him, they could dissolve the co-op and sell the properties and split the assets between the four of them. So three of them agreed, and on March 16th, their lawyer, who they had hired, sent a letter to Noel Thompson, who had been there for 25 years as a worker owner, and basically saying, well, it says, this letter is to provide formal notice to you that our clients intend to wind up the business, liquidate its assets, and distribute the net proceeds to the four of you. And Noel, who knew the intention of the founders, was to, A, try and keep the co-op going in perpetuity, but in the event that it should close, as happened to some wonderful co-ops like Burley, because they got overextended, the assets would be distributed amongst all of the current and former owners. And there's 50 former owners. And so Noel called one of us and said, hey, this is going on. What do you think? And he was like, well, it doesn't sound good. And so we started talking to each other and saying, well, we'd like to see the co-op continue because we think it's a really good thing. It's a neighborhood community bike shop, and we love the concept. But if it does get dissolved, it should be the assets should be distributed according to the original intent. And Noel was totally in favor of that. You know, he said, yeah, you know, I believe that we should follow what was the intent. And so he has hired a lawyer. And we are in support of him trying to keep the co-op going. And if he is unsuccessful in that, we would like to see all the former owners be compensated as was written in the Articles of Incorporation.
And there are records of how many hours each member worked and so forth.
It's all been their bookkeeper and has calculated exactly how much each person would get.
Sarah, have there been attempts to talk to these individuals, reach some compromise agreement, convince them, or are they pretty much not interested in dialogue?
Well, I was intimidated to go into the shop actually to discuss it, but I did write a letter and I sent it to these owners who were trying to close it, and I immediately was responded to by email that they had a lawyer and that please don't contact them with this matter, that I should talk to their lawyer. And many of the former owners wrote letters. And I do think some people went into the store and tried to dialogue directly, but I feel like it would take some courage to do that, and I didn't want to confront in that way.
Mm-hmm. And as somebody who was not a member of City Bikes, but a customer and a person who cares about justice and fairness, as you're talking, I'm getting, my blood pressure here is rising. And because of all the good work you and other members of City Bikes put through the years, and just because Portland's crazy real estate market has suddenly made properties that were bought for a small amount worth a lot, it's infuriating. And it also, if I may give you a personal note, is just, you know, these are wonderful models for how businesses should be in the world, and as equal, creatively, not always looking at the bottom, at the buck. So this is very upsetting. What could listeners do? Is there anything we could do to help? Besides give you $1.5 million to buy the place? I don't know what.
I'm not sure if Roger is more prepared than I am in this one, but I believe there is a Facebook page and a Instagram page called Save City Bikes. And maybe there's something else that we could say, but there is a petition that I believe would be accessible through there. And I feel like to just go in the shop and to be in there and experience it, and maybe to say you love the shop and that you wish it would continue. And I just feel like the neighborhood bike shops are one of the really positive things that we have in Portland, and to lose anyone is especially sad. But I don't know. Roger, do you have any ideas? I guess there's also a GoFundMe, because we did have a lawyer for $3,500 worth of lawyer listness, and then it became too much, and it's just too much.
I was going to say, that is that what they charge an hour?
It's too much. Anyways,
yeah, that's a lot.
There is also that, because even without hiring a lawyer, there's still work to do, and some of it does need money.
Roger, we have about 2 minutes, so if you could summarize what, how we could help, and where's the light at the end of the tunnel here?
Well, I'm not very much involved with the campaign, but I have to. But Brian Lacey, who worked at City Bikes and then went on to start the Community Cycling Center, has been actively involved in the GoFundMe and the campaign to get community support. I think continuing to support City Bikes would be a good thing, because they, you know, obviously they need to. And I think going in there and telling them that you support it. I think if people who work there are not happy working there, they should just leave. And I mean, like Bob, who is one of the mutineers, has a frame building business. I would encourage him to focus on that. And I don't think it's fair to destroy or dissolve a business that's perfectly viable for personal profit. And I would very much like to see the community supporting the concept of keeping the co-op alive, because it is a very good shop.
Amen. And as we say in the Jewish tradition, from your mouth to the ear of God, if there is a God, hopefully it is also a bike mechanic. You have been listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting on 90.7 FM, streaming on kbo.fm, and archived at www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. My name is Alon Rob, and I would like to thank our guest, Ruthie Woodring of Pedal People, Portland activist and former City Bikes members Sora Stout and Roger Norin, and to you also, good luck with this struggle and battle, because I think it's important, and you've done amazing work to help many, many people in Portland, including myself, to experience the joy of cycling. So you really, I really wish you well with this project and campaign. And I'd also like to thank co-host Nedra Deadweiler and our engineer Ty Walker. And a big thank you to you, our listeners, for joining us today. May all your rides be safe and joyful. Of a place to be, a little.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 11:59 a.m.
Más de 50 mujeres francesas de alto perfil se han filmado cortándose el cabello en apoyo a las mujeres y niñas iraníes que han sido asesinadas en las protestas por la muerte de Mahsa Amini después de su arresto por parte de la policía moral iraní. El video apareció el miércoles por la mañana en Instagram como Saoutien Femmes Iran, apoya a las mujeres iraníes, y el hashtag Hair for Freedom. También fue publicado en Twitter. En todo Irán, los manifestantes han tomado las calles bajo el lema Mujeres, Vida, Libertad, quemando pañuelos en la cabeza y confrontando a la policía y a los funcionarios de seguridad. Se desató una ola de ira después de que Amini, una mujer kurda de 22 años, muriera bajo custodia el 16 de septiembre, 3 días después de su arresto por presuntamente violar las estrictas reglas de Irán para las mujeres sobre el uso de velos en la cabeza y ropa modesta. El video francés hace eco de los que muestran a mujeres iraníes quitándose el